This is Steve Maxner continuing the interview with Mr. Ben Van Etten on the 15th of January, 2003, at approximately 2:55 Lubbock time. I'm in Lubbock, Texas, and Mr. Van Etten is in Alabama. Sir, why don't we go ahead and pick up with some of your general observations about serving in Vietnam and missions and things like that that you were participating in.
Okay. Just as I had mentioned previously, that Vietnam was an area that, depending on your luck of assignment, whether you got to live in an air-conditioned villa in Benoit or Saigon or Vung Tau, and probably spend most of your days there, and or you're actually out in the boonies fighting the war. The helicopter pilots at least had the advantage of being able to, even though we lived in the boonies, of occasionally being able to fly to town or fly to Vung Tau or fly to Saigon, and maybe get an overnight there or something to get a decent meal at a restaurant and a bath or something. But other than that, for most of the grunts and for most of the helicopter folks, you stayed out there in the field, and every day was fly all day and sometimes in the night, depending on what the missions were, and just your only rest was just right there. You just relaxed in your hooch or probably had a cocktail or beer, and that was about it. I think we talked previously about a typical mission scenario. How we would if we were going to move in for an infill type operation or move in for an air assault, we would have a brief of usually the evening before, and then normally they would take off before daylight, and then so we'd be ready to start this at first light or there or shortly thereafter. But of course, again, a typical one was the proposed landing zone. If nobody was there yet, you're going to be the first lift in. They would go ahead and prepare the zone usually by artillery and airstrikes, and just to make sure there's nothing there and nobody hiding out waiting for you. Right. And then we would do the infill, and as our troops occupied the area and moved to wherever their objectives or toward their objectives, we would withdraw and back to our base and wait for a call to either bring in more troops or go in and resupply them or bring out wounded in a lot of cases we took in hot meals for them in Mermite containers, from their main base. We would take in Sunday chow or not Sunday, just their chow for the day, and it could be hot meals for them sometimes.
Now, when you'd fly those types of missions, were you restricted geographically to where you would do that or by the unit? Or would you provide support for whomever needed it?
Well, yeah. Generally, we were in the support in the 3rd Corps area and sometimes the 4th Corps area, which is south of Saigon. 3rd Corps area being the more, north of there, and including Saigon and the north of Saigon. And we would support units that were in that area. Obviously, there were other helicopters based up in the 2nd Corps, 2 Corps area, and I Corps was probably mainly the Marine Corps up there supporting them. But we supported wherever within our Corps area, wherever the action was, which were many different units and many, several divisions, and also the Army folks too, the South Vietnamese Army.
Now, did you fly ARVN forces into hot landing zones very frequently?
Once in a while, not as much as we did the Americans, but we did occasionally support ARVNs and even by themselves, especially down in the 4 Corps area, because that's where at that time we didn't have. I think in later years they did, but when I was there, they didn't have much U.S. infantry down in the 4 Corps area, down in the what they call the Delta area. It was mainly just ARVNs down there.
Well, did you ever have any problems with ARVN?
Not really. I didn't really deal one-on-one, missions with them. I was usually as a part of a flight, which we were, was already a planned, troop movement, which wasn't any big deal. It was just pretty much they would go as planned, and there wasn't any combo we didn't really needed with them. They had their own command and control probably in another aircraft that would be speaking their own language to whatever they, whoever they needed to. And all I would do as a pilot would just follow in and fly in where they're supposed to and drop them off or pick them up, whichever it was, and take them wherever they need to go. Not really any problems. Well, like I said, I never really had any problems. I've heard of other people that did, but I never really had any with them.
You said you've heard of other people who had problems?
Well, just by simply through translation, through interpretation of what they wanted, whether or not they would give you the right suppressing fire you needed, that kind of thing. But I think a lot of that had to do with who their advisors and cadre were.
So mostly language problems. They wouldn't have English speakers with them, or they wouldn't be able to communicate well with the aircraft commander.
Yeah, that's about right. There's a, you know, of course there were people that were with them, Americans with them too, that we probably would normally would deal with the American that was their advisor. So he would already know what they're going to do, and he would have probably have an interpreter if he needed with him to be able to speak to their commander and so again, you know, different than later years at Air America where we did work one on one and individually with the local folks there, but in Vietnam, I didn't really get, other than hauling them around and resupplying them, and I didn't really get that involved with their, you know, discussions with them or anything.
Right. Did you ever have problems or ever hear of problems of some of the Arvin soldiers not wanting to dismount the aircraft in a hot LZ?
I never had that problem, but I've many times we watch them. You know, as soon as they, you drop off an American battalion, and they're going to immediately charge the perimeter and set up. They're there to fight. Well, the Vietnamese ones that I have worked with a lot of times would, the first thing they'd want to do is leave the aircraft, light a fire, and start cooking their rice. worry about the meal rather than what the possible objective might be.
Okay. And while you were flying these missions, what were the biggest anti-aircraft concerns that you had as far as weapons?
In Vietnam, it was mainly just small 30 caliber. I didn't ever encompass any what you consider AA like we did in Laos. Sometimes there was a 12.7, 50 caliber in the area, but I never personally got close enough to get bothered by any. I knew I was advised where they were and just stay away from there, and that's what I did.
Okay. Before your missions in Vietnam, I assume you went through some kind of a flight briefing through the Flight Operations Center. How were those conducted? How effective were they in giving you the essential information you needed? How accurate?
Well, when I was there, it was early in the game, in 65, and they weren't real accurate, I would say. I mean, we knew generally, our intelligence folks knew generally, you know, where the enemy was or probably was, and of course that was the reason we were taking troops in, to try to flush them out. And so, you know, a lot of those were kind of unknowns at that point. We, like I said, that's why we conducted missions where you just fly in a formation. The troops, you'd stay up at altitude, 3,000 feet or so until you got directly near your objective, and then you would swoop on down and let them out. But you, in route, you didn't give a, you didn't know whether they were good guys or bad guys, you know, just hanging out down below you, so you didn't give them an opportunity to shoot at you. All of our flights, or most of our flights, that was a, you know, a formation of flight, you know, of aircraft of, you know, 10 or 15, 20 aircraft, would also have gunship support with us. And either helicopters or Air Force. But, see, our own helicopter gunships, of course, we had instant combo with them. If anybody received fire, of course, you drop smoke right there where you receive the fire, continue on, of course, suppressing yourself with your door guns. But, meanwhile, the gunships would come on in and try to figure out where it came from and give it a whack, you know, let them know they shouldn't have shot at you.
Okay. How about going into LZs, were you concerned at all very much about RPGs, things like that yet?
Not RPGs. I never, just small arms. Like I said, our main, of course, I've been mortared a few times going into LZs, often, occasionally, because you just don't want to spend a lot of time in there if you're getting mortared.
Yes, sir. Okay. When you went on a missions, do you remember, were you surprised very often by what you encountered?
No, not in Vietnam. Generally, it was pretty cut and dry. We're going to, you know, like I think I mentioned in our last meeting, there were a couple of units, infantry units, that really took a whack, and it was generally for the same reason. They were sucked into a major ambush that was, you know, waiting for them, and they usually did it either at night or just about at night while we couldn't, and then they would lose commo, you know, when the radio would get shot out, and so you wouldn't know, you know, you couldn't go in there after anybody, you couldn't see anything, and so you just have to kind of orbit overhead until daylight to get on in there and rescue whoever was left. Mm-hmm. So, of course, those are surprises, you know, to them especially.
Yes, sir. Now, while you were flying in Vietnam, did you ever have to conduct an impromptu SAR, search and rescue of pilots or anything?
No, not really. Our unit was very fortunate. We didn't have any bad things happen for a long time, for at least 9 months we were there, and you know, where you had an aircraft go out and either get lost or get shot down. If anything happened, for example, I personally had an engine failure during one of the missions, but it was just the next ship in the, you know, I made a landing in the open area, and the next aircraft that was empty came right down and picked us up. So, you know, there wasn't any search and rescue, and I was just rescued. There wasn't any searching involved in my episode, and that was what was true of most of them in our unit, because we, I don't recall any individual ships going out and getting shot down that I can recall. Or, you know, in later other missions I could have, going ahead to Air America days, of course, there's a lot of, in fact, there were mainly single ship missions with Air America, so. Mm-hmm. But we were always usually with a formation of ships, so in Vietnam, or at least a couple more, so you mm-hmm. could watch each other.
Now, would you factor that in? I mean, it sounds like, would you have a couple of aircraft that were empty and flying along with you in formation in case something like that happened?
No, we didn't do that in Vietnam. We did that at Air America, but not in Vietnam. We didn't have an SAR bird, a designated bird. Mm-hmm. We would just pretty much rely that somebody in the form, you know, in the flight. Mm-hmm. Obviously, if it was happened going out, well, then you're all empty. Most of you are empty. If it happened going in, well, then you're coming in. You should be okay coming on in anyway. Where you're going to get shot at is either on the way out or on, you know, short final on the way in, but. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
No, we didn't designate an SAR.
Okay. And let's see. Any other specific missions that you recall while you were in Vietnam?
Well, I can recall you know, certain missions in certain areas that mm-hmm. were worse than other ones. You know, mm-hmm. where you definitely got a lot of resistance, and then the other ones were just, you know, more or less a piece of cake. There wasn't any shots fired that you were aware of. excuse me. The mission again. We talked about last time the Michelin plantation. Put a nice, pristine looking arrangement that with all the rubber trees and all the, you know, the plantation with all of its nice buildings and tennis courts, swimming pool, and that kind of stuff, and within the plantation. But of course, that became a battle zone later, and I can recall one incident where we had our B model aircraft, which were the gunships at that time, had some of them were mounted with a 40 millimeter nose gun that would shoot not a rapid fire, but, you know, maybe several every second off, you know, a 40 millimeter round, which is about like a grenade. Mm-hmm. And we had that fixed where the enemy were using, they would stay within the rubber plantation trees. You couldn't see them real well, but you knew they were in there. So to kind of shake them up, you would drop those grenades, you know, along the, periodically right along, let's say, the third or fourth row of trees within the plantation, see what came out. And also we would drop CS and CN gas in there, which was, as you know, it's just tear gas is all it is. It's not, when they smelled that, they didn't know what it was, because they were told we'd probably use poison gas, so they would literally come rolling out thinking they were going to die, but they were usually captured or taken that way. And that's happened. That happened around the Michelin plantation when I was up there, mm-hmm. especially earlier in the war.
How were they delivered?
We took some of them and had literally took the gun tubes on the side of the rocket tubes. I mean, not the gun tubes, the rocket tubes on the side of the gunship, and they were kind of like spring-loaded in there, and so the pilot could eject one or two and just kind of throw them out in front of him as he's flying along low and slow along the area where we thought they were. And they would just like canisters, you know, they were little like a can. That's what it looked like.
Right. And were these always in conjunction with ground operations by American forces?
No, we just used them once in a while. We tried, you know, tried different tricks to try to flush the guys out of the bad guys out of the area. And like I said, the only gas we had was CNCS, which is, you know, tear gas. So.
Right.
But again, the enemy didn't know what it was, I'm sure, and they weren't, they didn't have protective masks. Now, again, in the future stories on SAR missions in Laos, it was commonly to put down the CNCS gas to keep the gunners down, the enemy gunners down, if they came and made a rescue. With we'd use protective masks, or we, the Air Force, would. And of course, the enemy didn't generally have them, so they had to. That's why they were temporarily incapacitated, so you couldn't want to make the pickup.
Mm-hmm. So, again, we're jumping ahead, but just out of curiosity, in when you would deploy CNCS gas in Laos, you would actually also be wearing a gas mask.
Yeah, well, the Air Force did, and
the Air Force.
I was involved with near that, but their SAR birds were the Jolene Giants and their. And other bomber type aircraft, but even slow moving ones like A-1Es, they had that capability. Yeah, they would drop, and they would actually be, they were larger than just what we'd use in Vietnam. They actually had, I don't know how big they were, maybe 20, 40, 50 pound, or gallon, containers, for that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
They called it, I think the word was bedroll or something. They would blanket an area with that stuff if they needed to keep the anti-aircraft down while they went in and made the rescue.
Okay. For the back to your Vietnam time with the Army. Let's see. When did you leave?
I left it was around September or October of 66.
Okay.
I think it was around October 66, yeah.
Right.
October something.
Over the course of that year,
did
your opinion, or what was your opinion, and did it change at all concerning what the United States was trying to do in Vietnam?
Well, no, it really didn't change much. I mean, other than, during my tenure, we were more or less trying to get organized, trying to get our feet in the ground. The divisions of the buildup was still happening. The folks were still coming in, and we were still there to win the war. And I know in later years it became repetitive, and that's when you had a lot of other problems happen with the troops on dope and stuff. But we didn't have any of that when I was there that I was aware of. Now, we had some good times. I was going to mention that some of my good deals in Vietnam. I got to be it was just a luck of the draw, but for a week I got to be Ann Margaret's pilot and Johnny Rivers. Over there, and we literally took her around to different outposts, and where she met the troops and Johnny Rivers too and his folks, and then of course she put on a show back at their main garrison. But that was kind of neat. And then I saw Bob Hope at Christmas time in the winter of '65, and went down to Saigon to see him, and then we ended up hauling some of his people up to some of the other outlying areas where they went. Put on smaller shows than the one he put on down there. I also hauled Edgar Bergen and with Charlie McCarthy and them, and Robert Mitchum, and James Drury, who used to, I don't know if you ever heard of him. He played the part called the Virginian. All Robert Mitchum and James Drury did was just kind of go around and meet troop, talk to guys. They didn't put on a show or anything.
Right.
But anyway,
did you get to see Ann Margaret perform?
Yeah. I was her pilot.
So I imagine that you were able to stick around whenever you drop her off.
Yeah, I'd stay with her, and she put on her show, and then we'd pick her up and go on, take her back to town. And I didn't stay in town with her, unfortunately, but I'd take her the next day out to someplace else. And her, and like I said, she was traveling with Johnny Rivers at the time. And he had some people with him.
Okay.
Background, and so did she.
Mm-hmm.
She was nice, real nice, real young then.
Mm-hmm.
Very nice gal.
What else would you do for entertainment?
Well, other than those type of things, we had movies, kind of movies at our garrison area there. But I'm trying to remember what we had for a theater. I don't know whether we just had a a sheet on a wall or what. I really don't remember much on that, but other than that, just sit around and drink and wait for the next day's missions. And then occasionally we'd get to fly to Vung Tau, or we'd go down to the beach there for the afternoon or something, relax that way. Mm-hmm. But that was it in Vietnam. It wasn't much R&R in Vietnam. Now, I did have an R&R, a week of R&R to get out of the country. I went to Japan, mm-hmm. Tokyo, for a week.
Okay. How was that?
That was neat. That was actually, it was the first group of GIs that went up on that particular one. And they had just opened it up on a very limited basis for Americans to come into Tokyo. And of course, you couldn't wear a uniform. You couldn't, you know, you didn't want people, they didn't want you to let anybody know you were coming out of Vietnam. En route, we stopped at Taipei and had a lunch there at the Grand Hotel, Madame Chiang Kai-shek's hotel in Taipei that, of course, years later there, America, I got real familiar with Taipei, but God, it was neat going up. We went in and had a nice lunch buffet and with fresh strawberries and cream and things that you hadn't had in Vietnam.
Right.
And then went on up into Tokyo, and I think it was a group of about 10 of us, and stayed at various hotels. And I had a good, nice week. Me and this other GI that I was with up there, the first day we met this one of the, I think it was like the maitre d' at one of the restaurants within the hotel, the New Otani Hotel. Nice big, at the time it was brand new. It was a nice big hotel, and the Japanese guys took us out that next evening and to show us the town, which was really kind of neat. We went all around to the different sections and within Tokyo. I don't know if you've been there, but there's different sections, you know, and some of them are really like the Ginza is the highest priced section, and you got other sections that are less priced. So we went to visit a bar and a lounge at each one of them. And these guys, since they were in the restaurant business, they knew somebody at each one of them. So we had a good time that night.
Mm-hmm. So. Did you find that Americans were fairly welcome there?
Oh yeah, they were. You know, we weren't advertising that we were soldiers in Vietnam. Although the guys we were with, we told them. But yeah, we were just like any other, treated like other tourists, I guess.
Mm-hmm. And that was, you were treated well both in Taipei and in Tokyo?
Yeah, well, Taipei was just a matter of getting on the bus and going to that hotel, but we were, yeah, it was a nice stop for us.
Okay. In Vietnam, what was your food situation like?
We had, we built our own mess hall, and we called it a club.
Mm-hmm.
And we built it within it was like within the first month we were there, we hired the Vietnamese laborers and thing and just built a club. And there, at first, we just ate sea rations. But then as soon as that was built, we had a kitchen set up. And then actually, you could go there and eat a hot meal. Any time. Sometimes sea rations were better than the meal. But anyway, you go there and get a steak or go get a, you know, whatever, and a drink. And that's in that club we built is where they would have USO shows would come in. And we'd have entertainment that way, too. Maybe once a month or so, there'd be somebody there, not really big name people. People probably out of Las Vegas or out of Hollywood or something that come in and entertain us.
Mm-hmm.
We did that anyway. We got, like I said, we built our own hooches, built our own everything. The revetments, mm-hmm. where the aircraft were, and
right.
Just what we could carry with us.
Mm-hmm.
Now another side note: when Vietnam was first getting built up in '65, we had some older, more experienced soldiers and our old warrant officers in our unit that knew how to get things. And of course, we arrived without a whole lot of stuff. I mean, we had our basic, what you consider issue, but we didn't, for example, the club that we built there, we didn't have all the supplies you would need to put a club, you know, all the silverware and plates and all the other things you need to, and tables and chairs you need for a club. So we took one of our Jeeps, which was a brand new Jeep, we had several, and traded it to somebody. And I don't know who it was. I mean, Cy wasn't in on it, but I know we traded a Jeep for all the stuff to supply a club to some other American someplace that already had that. You know, just of course, with land pension, they just write them off as a combat loss, and it's gone. We also we were just living in GP medium tents to begin with, and then one day one of our low boy, which is a hauling truck, comes up with probably 20 or 30 brand new Calvinator refrigerators right in the still in the boxes, and one was parked in front of each tent where it's so we could have a, because that was always a problem, so getting cold water or keeping drinks cold and so on. There wasn't much ice around up there, mm-hmm. so we at that time. So, but now we had the problem we didn't have enough power to run them. So, the next day somehow that somebody acquired a two big Air Force 150 kW generators, which agreed that that's enough power there to run a small town, and so we had them set up too, and then finally so we had power to run our refrigerators.
Mm-hmm.
But that was all done by scrounging.
Mm-hmm.
And I think more or less you just drive with a little forklift and a low-boy truck, you drive into the docks of Saigon where all this stuff is and look official and act like you know what you're doing, and drive up and just pick them up. Another thing, we also got, at that time, the M16 was just coming out.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, our issue weapons was just a 45 pistol, and I had acquired, all of us had acquired an extra one. Like I had a Thompson that I got from somebody, and somebody else had a shotgun and things with them. But we carried, but one day they came in, and a guy had boxes of brand new M16, so each of us got an M16 to stick it behind our seat there in the aircraft. And at that time, the infantry still hadn't got them all. They still had M14s, more a lot of the infantry people. But we had, so they'd get on our aircraft, we'd haul them, and we'd be wearing Vietnam jungle suits with that M16 strapped behind the seat, and they'd be wearing regular fatigues with a M16, or M14, but anyway. That was just the scrounging business.
Mm-hmm. Well, were there, did you experience any shortages of anything in particular?
No, I mean, we had we had everything we needed. I think we had our own flight surgeon with a small medical detachment with us, and so as far as that type of thing, it was all taken care of. For minor things, minor ills and aches and pains, we had the food was adequate. It was okay. Wasn't great, but it was okay, and. Of course, we each had our own. Eventually, each two-man hooch that we built ended up with a refrigerator. So we had always had cold drinks in that refrigerator and that type of stuff. So we could, and then with C rations, of course, back which were later days was MREs, but back and then there was C's, and we always had plenty of them to munch on. So there wasn't really any shortage. I suppose you've probably heard about what they called the shitters, the latrines.
Yes, sir.
And where they actually burned them, mm-hmm. they were you could picture like a four or five holder, an outhouse, and then underneath that, which was just screens around the outside of it, but underneath it was like barrels of cut off barrels that where you would where you'd go into, and then every day or so they'd dump some JP4 or diesel into those and light them on fire. And that would just burn off the. Of course, that was always interesting.
Yes, sir.
Our shower was a peak. We got some B-52 wing tanks and mounted them up high enough, and then ran some little faucets out of them spigots out of them so that we just fill them with water and you have your shower. Of course, sitting out there in the hot sun in Vietnam, you'd have warm water.
Mm-hmm. I would imagine it got downright hot.
It got warm, but of course, for half the year it rained so much that even though it was warm, you got cooled down by the rain.
Okay.
I'm thinking about another mm-hmm. little sidelight. We had a trench we had dug in behind where our flight platoons lived at first in tents, and we had some trenches kind of dug in behind it just in case we got mortared or something, we could jump into that trench. Well. What we were doing, and this was it really wasn't really the wet season yet. It was still kind of dry at this time, and you'd eat your MREs or whatever else you had, and you'd just throw your garbage into that trench.
Mm-hmm.
Well, eventually, of course, that attracts rats and mice, and of course, who eats those but snakes? So eventually, we realized we'd build ourselves a little snake pit right behind
mm-hmm.
there. So one night we did get mortared the first time, and it was middle of the night, and I just got out there set behind some sandbags and figured that's where I'm going to sit. I'm definitely not going to jump into that trench out there. Although we did clean it out the next day in case we got murdered again. They would know it wasn't full of snakes or something.
Did you eat any local cuisine, like snakes or...
Not like that. No, not there. We, I mean, the only local cuisine that we would eat would, I would eat would, if I happened to go to Saigon or you know, Bung Tao or Benoit, we, you know, go to a restaurant, mm-hmm. local restaurant, mm-hmm. a noodle stand or something.
Right. Okay.
No, I never, you know, with the mountain yards and that kind of thing, like right. we did. Now, in Laos, we did that type of stuff, but not
in Vietnam.
Not in Vietnam.
Okay. And what about interacting with the Vietnamese people? Did you have much contact with civilians, Vietnamese
not,
civilians?
Not really. Only the house girls that came in daily to do the chores around the, you know, do everybody's laundry and mm-hmm. And clean up around there, mm-hmm. around the hooches, and that was it. And that was really our only interaction, other than, you know, with soldiers that we hauled, but that wasn't. I really didn't have that much interaction in Vietnam with the local folks.
Okay. When you, how did you feel when you were getting ready to leave?
Happy to get out of there. I didn't have any bad feelings about that the thing was being not being run right. When we did a lot of missions that we kind of thought were kind of poorly planned, but then we were thinking, well, we had never done that before, so, I mean, hopefully live and learn. A problem with Vietnam was that the rotation normally for most folks was a year. And so let's say an aviator comes in and he's going to spend his first couple months getting trained up so he's effective. And then he's going to fly real good through his middle part of his tour, and then toward the end he's going to be a short-timer and probably not going to want to fly much. He'll just, what we call, join the Seagull platoon, which means you just eat and shit and walk on the beach and don't only fly if somebody throws rocks at you. Mm-hmm. But the problem with that is that now, unless your rotations would come in on a regular basis where you've always got old guys who are training new guys, but mm-hmm. like in our unit, we came in all together. So therefore, we were all about due to rotate together. So toward the end of our tour, they started trying to stagger us. Either they would send some of us to other units to fly or out of our unit, so we'd bring in people that had like a mid-tour time there from that other unit, so they would be there to help train the new guys. We, during my tour, of course, we always had an experienced guy to put in the cockpit with the new guy, and which is real important over there. In later times, of course, your experienced guy had probably been there a month longer than the other new guy, mm-hmm. which I'll guarantee you, when a young pilot gets to Vietnam and he's just out of flight training, like I told you earlier, I was lucky enough to go to a high time flying unit in Germany first, and had a couple of years of fast flying under my belt before I got to Vietnam. But a lot of guys didn't have that, and you know, if you can picture you're flying an overloaded aircraft, you're it's combat. You're flying fast. You're flying formation. You're trying to read a map. You're trying to land and take off in tight areas. You're directing door gunners. You know, other things going on. Maybe you're getting shot at, so you know you got to be pretty cool, mm-hmm. and you learn to be pretty fast. And if you make it through a tour in Vietnam as a helicopter pilot, you're definitely were a real hot pilot by the time you got out of there. If you live that long, mm-hmm. you know, if you live that long and didn't have an accident or a bad accident, but you learn by you know, a lot. Most of them just had to learn by experience getting in there and doing it and hoping they make it, and like I said, once they leave, they're in good shape. But again, back to what I was talking about, the year's tour, they probably should have made it, looking back, maybe a little bit more than a year. Of course, the initial thought was, like I think I told you before, is, you know, the guy, well, yeah, we want to get that Vietnam rotation and get the medals and get those points on our records, and then we'll get, because who knows how long this war is going to last. It may only, you know, the thinking was it's only going to last a couple of years at first. You know, it's going to get in there, kick ass, and get out, and it's over with. But obviously it didn't turn out that way, but that was the thought. So that was probably the idea for the one-year rotation, to give, you know, as many soldiers as they could a chance to get to Vietnam. But and that was a big, you know, difference when I got with Air America. You'd have guys that have been there for 10 years, you know, doing the same thing. So.
Yes, sir. Well, upon leaving,
yeah.
Did you already know where you were going, what your plans were?
I knew I was getting discharged, and that was my plan. And I went to, flew out of Vietnam, and ended up landing in Oakland, I think it was, that area of San Francisco area, California, and got discharged right there, and then got met by a friend of mine that was living there in California, one of my high school and college friends, and he met me, and because I'd written him, told him when I was coming in, and I stayed overnight with him, and next day got in a plane for Dallas. My wife was in Mineral Wells at the time, and got to Dallas, and she met me, and we were home. It wasn't, there weren't any protesters. There weren't any, I didn't even see any. Wasn't even aware of anything like that at that point. I don't think any of that had really started, where your planes landed and coming from Vietnam and in the ports of California there. I just, got out and went about my business and really didn't notice anything like I think it happened to other people.
Right. Well, during the whole time you were there, what did you ever come up against what you were told were NVA units? Were they all Viet Cong?
Well, I don't know. My assumption was they were probably a mixture all the time. I never had the eyeball contact with the troops, with the enemy troops, like the guns would. Mine was just, flashes from somebody shooting at me, and which I'd shoot back. But I really didn't. And so I didn't know. All I knew is that they were bad guys,
right.
Charlie.
What about during briefings? Did you recall if suspected enemy activity in a particular area where you were operating? Did they say explicitly, yes, there's an NVA, there are NVA units in this area or anything like that?
Yeah, that's what the most briefings were about. They would generalize and say, okay, we happen to know that this particular regiment or something was operating within this area because the villagers have told us, and where they've been spotted, and humma humma, that kind of thing, or we've had some of our vehicles ambushed or booby or landmine, along this particular route. So therefore, the assumption was, they live in the, in the wood and the jungle and probably underground in a lot of cases, and that's where they're going to be. So we're going to, we try to pick our landing zones as close as we can, but we're not right in the middle of them. Obviously.
Did, over the course of your tour, did you notice if progressively you were encountering more NVA as opposed to VC?
Yeah, they were getting more and more as the tour went on. Like I said, we had been there for a while before we actually had confirmed kills of NVAs. The rest were mainly VC, and same with the prisoners. I just happened to think of another story. One of the aircraft in each platoon normally would have what they call a command and control console in that aircraft. And what that crew would do is you would fly probably the commander or maybe a higher division commander or staff in that console, and they would be, and then you would continually be orbiting above the area wherever the operation's going on, and they would be talking to the folks on the ground and doing the, on their own frequencies, although we could monitor all that up front of the aircraft anyway, one time I was given the command and control mission, and they came and told me, said, okay, there's a general named General Depew that's coming down. He was in the 25th of one star. He made four stars later, but anyway, Depew, and he's going to become the 1st Infantry Division commander, and he's, right now, the 1st Infantry Division, we were supporting them on a big exfil mission. And he said he's interested in watching that operation. So fly him, and I think he was by himself, actually. He didn't have an aide with him, by himself. So just fly him and pretty much let him, take him wherever he wants to go and let him observe. And we had a command radio in the back of that so he could monitor our call or whatever he wanted to do. So we're flying this general around and watching all the different exfils. It was an exfil mainly for that day. Evacuation of an area that they were finished with, and there was a call. So we got a VC prisoner down here, and we don't have any place. What are we going to do with him? Because we don't have, all the aircraft were getting full of the Americans leaving, and we didn't. What we're going to do with that enemy prisoner? And so the general kind of looks at me and says, "Can we pick him up?" And I said, "Yeah, if you want to, sir." So So we went down and picked him up, and the general jumps out with his M16, and he goes and marches this prisoner, because I'm sure the people on the ground didn't realize it. He had little tiny black stars on his collar. You couldn't really tell. He just looked like an older soldier, and he's kind of short, too. He was probably only 5'6" or so. And, his name was DePew. So anyway, he marches the prisoner back to our aircraft, and we take off. And, of course, the procedure then, I even called, I said, well, what do you think we should do with him? I think they're S3 or something. They said, well, we can't take him because we're all heading back to our main base. Why don't you call Special Forces because they've got interrogators and all that and take him there. So I called a Special Forces camp right not too far from there called Duqua. And I told him, I said, I'm coming in with a prisoner. I need somebody to meet me. They had like a compound, but outside the compound was a small airstrip. And I said, I'll land at the airstrip and have somebody come out and meet me and pick up the prisoner. So the general, again, he marches that we land. The sergeant comes running out of the Special Forces camp. And the general just marches him on up to the sergeant. And, you know, he's got him, but I don't think anybody realized along the way that was actually a general that I was that was doing all that prisoner escorting. But,
mm-hmm.
Anyway, that was kind of a neat thing for him. He was, he made 2 stars right after that. Then I think, like I said, it was 3 and 4 later.
Mm-hmm.
But,
that's amazing. Did you pick up many other prisoners over the course of your tour?
Occasionally, I'd pick up prisoner. Mainly, I'd pick up wounded Americans. There was the dust off units, but if you're already working in an area and a guy just gets shot or gets wounded, they're going to load him on the first chopper available. You know, we'd fly him down to the hospital down at Long Bend. I think it was called the 93rd Evac, I believe, or 92nd or 93rd. But anyway, it was the closest hospital to the area, and we just fly him right directly there. You know, we'd call him ahead and say we're coming in with a wounded guy, and they'd meet us and get him. So we did a lot of what you could consider a dust off mission. We're done by just regular slicks.
What would you say was the hardest mission you had?
The what?
The hardest mission, the most difficult mission.
Oh, in Vietnam, I would say was probably things that went into the nighttime, and then we're trying to fly at night and do the same thing. We're doing, for example, a lot of areas you could only land one aircraft at a time,
mm-hmm.
So everybody would orbit overhead you, and then as your turn came up, you would go down to the landing to this point, which is probably just on the road down there in between the trees,
mm-hmm.
Pick up, if that was wounded, we're picking up, pick up as many as you can and kind of hover straight up out of there and then fly away. Well, one night we were in a flight of probably 10 or more aircraft, and you fall on the guy in front of you, and you're in a large, very large orbit overhead,
mm-hmm.
And then the lead would go in and say, I'm going down, and then he'd make his pickers, I'm coming out, and the next guy said, okay, number 2 is going in. And then finally get to you. So the only thing you can really see along the way is the lights of the guy in front of you because it's dark. And once he's in and out, well, then finally you would circle down. You knew about where you were going. Then you would wait for either a flashlight or a chem light signal of some kind down there where you're headed. But, it's pitch dark now, so you'd more or less hover straight down into the area because we knew there were tall trees all around it. I mean, everybody mentioned it. So that made it a little difficult to get in and out of there. I got in weather a couple of times over there. Weather was always bad, especially during the monsoons. And,
mm-hmm.
and there weren't, with lightning going on and all that, it was easy to get the vertigo situation. And
mm-hmm.
I got in that situation one time. And, I worked out of it, of course, and that was kind of exciting. And then ended up, me and my crew ended up one time staying in a field location by ourselves. It got really foggy and rainy, and it was late at night, and we were trying to do missions out there, and finally we landed at this place, and we didn't have enough visibility to get out of it. Now, we knew there were enemy around there, but we didn't know where, so we just shut down and sat in the aircraft seat all night, and the door gunners sitting with their guns ready, and we were sitting with until we could get first light to get out of there, but nothing happened, but I think we would have been an easy target for somebody raiding in there, but anyway... That happened one night, and then another mission was. Let me think. They weren't really, they weren't hard. I mean, they were just. I mean, where I got medals and things for it wasn't any different than most of them.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, every day was something.
Yes, sir.
Going and picking up somebody and getting them out of there,
mm-hmm.
But it was just a normal procedure. I didn't really worry about it that much. Well, you worried about getting shot, of course.
Of course.
Now, you know the other things that and this is true in Laos, that your television or your movies can't depict very well, and there's a couple things. And one is the intense noise of bombs and guns going off and bombs going off around you, or rockets going off. That's very, very loud. And if you're close enough to like a napalm, and the heat of that is something else too. Even though maybe you're 100 meters away from it, I mean, it's just like a blast to you. If you're down, where they're trying to suppress a fire around you so you can take off again or land, and that's what you used to do. You'd coordinate an Air Force strike along with your trying to take off. If you know there are bad guys over there, and they're going to shoot at you as soon as you get above the tree line. So you try to suppress them as they're striking the area, then that's when you take off and get out of there. But that's the type of, it's that. You can't depict the smell. Some areas where there's been bodies, there was one area where we hit this machine gun nest where the Air Force did, and there were like four or five charred bodies in it, and they were just left there. And, man, you could smell them at 1,000 feet in the air, it's just flying over it. And,
my goodness.
And the smell of combat, the smell of burning, the smell of napalm, the smell of things that, like a lot of gunfire. And then the other thing is the fear that you feel for a little bit, at least, as you're going in on a mission. There's just a bit of it. You tighten up a bit, as they say, the pucker factor.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, I'll have to say that after literally thousands of missions over the years, I got pretty well used to it. But, if it was first in Vietnam, that was pretty exciting.
Yes, sir.
But those are the type of things that Hollywood really can't depict, because it's hard to convey smell, it's hard to convey that much noise, and it's hard to convey fear or apprehension like you'd feel.
Well, what was your biggest fear? Was it fear of getting killed?
Fear of getting shot, probably. At that point. I didn't worry about crashing. I felt I could handle the aircraft pretty well by that point. And that wasn't, and the same with the guy that I normally flew with, this guy, Captain Silva, Ed Silva. He and I normally flew together, and most of the time, and I trusted him too. So, I mean, I could didn't have to see. I also flew with a lot of real young pilots too. When they would come in, of course, there you let them fly as much as you can, but you've always got to be real close to the controls yourself so you don't crash. But I wasn't that with Ed. I wasn't that concerned.
Sounds good. Sir, this will end CD number one of the interview with Mr. Ben Van Etten. This is Steve Maxer continuing the interview with Mr. Ben Van Etten on the 15th of January 2003 at approximately 4 o'clock Lubbock time. This is also the beginning of CD number two. Was there anything else that you wanted to discuss about your time in Vietnam before we move on?
No, not really. They were, humorous side stories that I don't know if that's it's even relevant, but they're kind of.
Well, what comes to mind?
Well, one in particular was our commander, as I mentioned on our last, the other time we talked, was kind of weird. We used to joke about having him in combat with you and that kind of stuff, and sure enough, he turned out there. Well, he would like to fly on the command and control bird a lot of times overhead when there's going to be when we're doing a mission, a large multi-ship mission. And his co-pilot on this one particular mission was a guy named another major named Martinez, his nickname was Marty, and he was actually the S2, which is the intelligence guy supposedly, and we called him Major Smarty. And he thought that was a compliment because he was the S2, smart.
Mm-hmm.
But it was just the opposite. The guy was so ignorant that's why everybody called him Smarty. It was an inside joke about everybody. But so anyway, Major Smarty and Major Reed were flying the command and control ship, and we landed in a landing zone that as soon as we hit it started taking quite a bit of fire, incoming fire. And so of course the idea is you discharge your troops as quickly as you can. And of course, you get out of there as quickly as you can. But you go out in formation. You don't, the number four ship doesn't fly past the number three ship, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, it'd be dangerous, to do that. So, I'm back in about the 8th or 9th area, went toward the rear, and our as soon as we discharged our troops and we're getting ready to go, the number two aircraft, quite a bit in front of us, catches on fire. It got some kind of a, took some kind of a hit and caught him on fire. Well, the crew there announces, you know, I'm on fire, I've been hit, I'm evacuating my aircraft. And, of course, all he had to do was get out of his aircraft, him and his, the crew of four, the two gunners and the two pilots, and just get into the next empty aircraft and we're out of there. But Reed comes over the radio and says, this is an order. He said, this is Tomahawk 6. That was his call sign. This is Tomahawk 6. He said, I order you to, everybody hold your place. We're coming in to get them. Well, there was, number one, that was dumb. Who wants to stay on the ground any longer with that incoming? Maybe the next one. And Reed didn't need to come in because, well, like as it turned out, all they had to do was get in the next aircraft. So whatever the guy's call sign was, let's just say it's Tomahawk 3-2. He says, Tomahawk 3-2, this is Tomahawk 6. I'm coming to get you, you know. Well, of course, Tomahawk 3-2 isn't going to answer him because he's already evacuated his aircraft. Mm-hmm. And everybody knew that. And so we're all sitting there in what you call light, you know, pretty, you know, ready to go. We got the pitch partially pulled up where you were light on the skids and ready to move on out. And of course, that aircraft's burning. And Reed again says, this is an order. Nobody move. Everybody stay and hold your position. We're coming in to get them. So him and Marty Martinez, which neither one of them could fly, were the beans. And they came in and did this hairy fly side flare and come down and hit the dirt hard right next, right near the burning aircraft. And darn near tipped their own aircraft over. Well, as soon as they landed, the next thing you hear is screaming on the radio, Tomahawk 6 has been hit. Tomahawk 6 has been hit. You know, and he's going on about how he got the bullet. So our gunships, which are their call sign is Gunslinger, and they're kind of orbiting in the area right now and looking for targets. And, and the Gunslinger says, yeah, Roger, this is Gunslinger 6, or Tomahawk 6. Where did the fire come from? And this is a classic. And, of course, we're sitting there waiting to get out of there. Right. Meanwhile, when all this conversation is going on, and he says, the bullet came in the right window, or my right door window. It shot off my trigger finger. It hit my chest protector. It shot off my trigger finger. Luckily, he was wearing a steel chest protector. And then hit Tomahawk 2 Alpha on the way out, went out the other side. Roger, Tomahawk 6, but where did the fire come from? He goes through this long dissertation again about it came in this door and it ricocheted here and it shot his finger and on and on, and then he says, and I'm out of here to the hospital. And he takes off again and they're going to fly themselves to the hospital. So, meanwhile, nobody else took any hits and the rest of us were out of there. So, anyway, that's not the end of the story. So the next day, see, I knew I was with him in Germany because I knew his family and everything. And so I figured, well, he got wounded. I guess I better go visit. And that was my day to kind of fly the ash and trash guys going to Saigon, fly the mail around to people that were in the hospital and that kind of thing. And so, I'll just land out the hospital today and visit and take him his mail and visit him, you know, for a minute, being his old buddy. Mm-hmm. So, the 93rd evac hospital is really grim. You can imagine this was a prefab type building, quarters and quarters of burn cases, amputees, all these really serious wounded guys. And so I'm walking down this long corridor, and I asked this nurse, I said, where's Major Reed at? And he said, oh, he's at the end bunk down in this bay, so-and-so. So I'm walking down with his mail, and I kind of walked in behind him, and he's sitting there having an interview with his hometown newspaper, and his bed's all jacked up where it's, you know, where he can sit up, you know. Mm-hmm. And then he's got one of these, there's like a little rope coming from the ceiling, coming all around, a bunch of pulleys and around to hold his hand up, and all it was, he got a wounded, he didn't lose his finger, he got a shot in the finger, and it's all bandaged up, and it's up in the air, and it's being held up by this pulley type apparatus. And so, and then in his other hand, he's got his chest protector, which had a the one from the mission, which had a good mark right in the middle. If he wasn't wearing that, he would have caught it right in the heart. But anyway, so that really saved him. But anyway, he's telling this hometown reporter or somebody, some interviewer on him, about how he and his partner saved the day and went in to save these pilots and how, you know, what a hero he was. And I'm sitting there listening to this, and he doesn't know I'm standing there. And finally... Finally, I kind of moved around where he could see me, and I just say, hey, how you doing? Here's your mail. And I just walked off. He knew right away that I could just tell by the way his face dropped that I'd heard his bullshit. Mm-hmm. And So anyway, the other funny thing was when they got back, finally he got, and he wasn't that wounded, but he did get rotated another unit. But anyway, when he and Martinez got back, they put themselves in for the DFC, both of each other, for the Distinguished Flying Cross. Well, that was another joke. Of course, everybody knew the whole story there, you know, around the, and his got turned down, but that gave the rest of us an opportunity to go ahead and put in for a, that's how we kind of, a lot of us got DFC out of other missions, though. We said, well, heck, if he thinks that was a DFC, it was a lot of other missions that were a lot more heroic than that, you know, junk bucket of worms was. And, and so anyway, but anyway, that's
my goodness.
Yeah, that's the story I think read, but it's...
Well, that brings up an interesting question. What do you think was the most heroic or the bravest thing you witnessed in Vietnam during that your first tour?
I don't think all the pilots, you know, I wasn't on the ground with the grunt, so I don't know, you know, hand to hand or that type of thing.
Well, but from your perspective.
But for the pilots,
you guys did some pretty hairy things.
Yeah, there was just a normal everyday mission. It was just a day's work. I don't think anything really that heroic. We had one of our pilots volunteer to go back. We had an aircraft that was down, but it probably could have been with a little bit of minor maintenance fix to get out. He worked with a maintenance pilot, so he went. He volunteered to go in to get that aircraft out, which they did. They went in and got it. I thought that was pretty good, but because you know they were going to be shot at on the way in. But of course, years later, you know that was Vietnam when I got to. You know the real war was in Laos, and, so,
okay.
And that's about where the you talk about. Sticking it out, but you know, I mean, even personally, you know, our mission, we went in and picked up wounded guys, and that was just part of the job,
yes, sir.
You know, and went in being mortared. Luckily, the one time we were mortared it was down in the four corps, and that's mainly rice paddies down there. It's pretty flat terrain, and the rice paddies had some water in them, so or at least they were muddy. They were had so little water, and so. When the mortars started coming in, and actually the enemy just used these, usually like a 62 millimeter mortar, which wasn't a very big round, you know. But I mean, unless it hit you, of course, it'd be pretty big. But as far as shrapnel traveling a long ways, you know, like a R4 Deuce mortar was a pretty big one.
Right.
But luckily the mortars that came in near us went into the mud, and then went off. So all it was really doing was spraying the area with mud, and. That was pretty lucky because they were hitting fairly close to us on that day. There was three or four of them went off before we could get out of there. But luckily nobody took anything bad because it was dissipated in the mud. But those are just to me was just a daily routine.
Yes, sir.
When you
left Vietnam and
yeah.
got back to the United States. At what point did you realize you wanted to go ahead and get hired on to become a
pilot
instructor?
Well, I was in Vietnam because I was aware of Air America. I think did I send you that? That's when I wrote about how I planned to go to Air America eventually.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. Sure
okay, did. So that kind of explains that I had you know I couldn't apply at all. I was out of the Army at that time. They weren't taking people from active duty. You had to be out of active duty.
Right.
So when I got back to the States, I sent them a, I think I called them and they sent me an application. I filled it out and sent it to them and went to work immediately for Southern Airways and as a flight instructor there at Camp Walters, which was the, you know, the Army Primary Helicopter School. My wife was from anyway, so we just went back there so I worked there and waiting to see what was going to happen with Air America and. And they called me, as I mentioned in my story, other story, that they called me with a job situation, but it was to go back to Saigon, fly Hueys, and of course, Air America take your family. And I just didn't want to move the kids, four at that time, three kids, with a fourth on the way, to Vietnam. You know, I told them, I said, I'd like to live in Thailand, and we could, and, I mean, I know about the Udo in Thailand operation, and they fly in Laos, H-34s, and I said, mainly H-34s. So they had Hueys up there, too, but, so that's what I'd rather do. And then, of course, the answer was, no, we don't have any openings there. We only have a need for people in Saigon, so, you know, goodbye. So that was it. So I continued to work with Southern Airways for... And it was just about 18 months to the day when I got I don't remember if it was a telephone call or a telegram, but from the same hiring agent up there in Washington, D.C. that hired the Air America guys and the CIA case officers, named read H.H. Dawson, mm-hmm. and he said, if you're still interested in Thailand, give me a call, which I did, and went up there for the interview the next day, and told my I was a flight instructor, but my students were all solo by that time, so I told my boss that I wanted to go up and interview the next day, and send my students solo, and I'll be back Monday. It was like Thursday, so I'll be up there Friday and be back to work Monday. But anyway, that's when I got hired. So. Mm-hmm. That was the start of another adventure, which I was looking forward to.
Yes, sir. So this was 1969 when you got hired?
It was 68.
Oh, it was 68?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I left there, I left the Army in 66, mm-hmm. and then 18 right. months later was...
hired on with Air America. Mm-hmm. Now, you had heard about Air America back in 1963.
Yeah, long, I'd heard rumors about it in 63, and then when I, actually even before I became a pilot, went to flight school, I'd heard about it, mainly just rumors and so on, and then because at that time, active duty Army aviators and Marine Corps aviators would go there like a tour of duty with Air America, and then stay there for a year or so, and then either go back to their to the military or resign from the military and stay with Air America. But which a lot of them did both. But anyway, so I'd heard about it, and I was really interested in what they did as far as just the adventure. I wasn't, and then I knew they made good money too, and that was those are the initial main considerations was a. Was the adventure or the challenge of that time of flying and the money.
When did you leave Air America?
I left in latter part of November of 72.
Okay.
So it was just short of 5 years.
Right.
From November to December. Anyway, the late fall of 72.
Okay. Now, did you know at the time when you got hired in 1968 that Air America was actually an owned and operated airline for the CIA?
No, I didn't for sure. I mean, I'd heard that. Mm-hmm. That was the rumor, but it wasn't put out even by the company. It was at that time you were going to go to work for a private company that was owned by the Pacific Corporation, a mm-hmm. private outfit,
right?
And which was a pseudo company, a Delaware corporation set up for that, but it was really your principals were government officials.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
But anyway, it's mm-hmm. what we found out later, which is fine. We I was looking forward to that. That was an adventure. I mm-hmm. the deal was I was hired, and I could, of course, a lot of this now is in that other thing I wrote you. I don't know if mm-hmm. you want me to say it again or.
I guess what we could do is we could do one of two things. I do have them in front of me, and the one that describes your experiences getting hired is called Lofty Goals.
Yeah. Okay.
And it really kind of depends on whether or not you you feel it's okay for us to include this in the transcript or include it, allow people to have access to it.
Yeah.
It's up to you.
That'd be okay. I can probably elaborate a little more on some of
right.
that.
Right. Yeah, and we would want to do that.
Yeah. So. I can kind of paraphrase what I've said. I mean, I know what the first 9 months, or the first 90 days mm-hmm. Was my training and probationary period. And then after that, if you were still with the company and mm-hmm. everything in good graces, then you could bring your family over if you wanted to, and which
well,
I did.
What did your wife think about you seeking employment with this?
Oh, she was always game. She'd been to Germany with me already, and so that bit of traveling, and we had three small babies at that point.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, the fourth one was born just about the time that I was getting ready to be hired by Air America. So when she came over, that baby was only like a few months old,
mm-hmm.
3 months old, 3 or 4 months old. Mm-hmm. But no, she was looking for the adventure too. She thought it was neat.
Mm-hmm.
She was just game to do whatever I wanted to do, and she's always been that way.
Mm-hmm. What when you were hired, when you received after you received the contract, sent it back, describe the process of getting over back to Southeast Asia.
I was sent plane tickets to I don't really remember which direction I went, but I ended up in Taipei. I guess so, the Pacific. I mean, I don't know whether I went through Seattle or California or what. I was in Dallas at the time, so or Fort Worth, so or actually Mineral Wells. So I obviously departed out of a probably Love Field back then. I don't think DFW was there yet, but out of Love Field, and then headed west through. I don't even remember the route, but anyway, ended up in Taipei. And that's where Air America's Far Eastern headquarters was in Taipei. From there, we did the in-processing with the company and went through a flight. I took another flight physical with them, I believe, at that point. And then also got an ATP training, air transport or training there, too, of ground school.
Mm-hmm.
Seemed like we were there a couple weeks, and it just happened that there were three other guys on the same plane going over with me, and we got together on a long flight, figured out that we were all going to Air America. Two of them were Army retired guys.
Mm-hmm.
One guy was a younger guy, probably about my age. It was a fixed-wing pilot, and then I was a other chopper pilot. And so we went to Taipei, in-processed, ended up from there after about 2 weeks or so, and ended up in Bangkok. And went through H-34 ground school. At least three of us did. The Dixon, who was the fixed wing guy. I don't remember what happened to him at that point because he ended up going to Vientiane where to fly a co-pilot on like C-123s or Caribous to begin with, and then we ended up going to Udorn, of course, flying H-34s. But the in-processing, of course, and then at that point, the two guys I was with all knew a lot of several other guys that were with Air America from the old days. And one of them met us down there in Bangkok, and when we were there, and took us around and kind of chauffeured us around too, and got us started. But a couple things I distinctly remember about that course: the ground school was interesting and all that, and we went through it. I'd already, all of us were already rated in that aircraft, but it was a matter of getting refreshed on it. And then there's the way we got from Bangkok to Udorn, our base. We went on a train, and the train is what they call the night train. It took all night. You get on at like 6 in the morning, or 6 in the evening, and then you'd arrive up in Udorn about 6 in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and there was like little sleep bays on it so you could sleep. But that was the ride up. I believe it was the train. Now looking back, it may have been a bus, come to think of it. But anyway, it was a long ride up there, whichever way we went. But, of course, in later years, we drove with our own car all the time. But got up there to Udorn, checked into a hotel where they recommended we stay in while we're and started our in-processing up there, getting our flight gear together and getting ready for flight training, and which began right away. And like I think I mentioned on my story there, I hadn't been in an H-34 for several years. Let's see, I'd been... about 3 years, I guess, and since I'd flown one, and it's always a little rusty. and my first ride happened to be with the chief, the senior pilot, Abity, and Ab, as we called him, and he was kind of not unfriendly, but just kind of pretty serious about his work. He was one of the first pilots with Air America.
Mm-hmm.
If you read any of that, you probably saw his name in some of the history.
Yes, sir.
He got anyway with. Ab flew with me, and my flight was not good. I mean, I like I said in my story, I wondered if they were fired or anybody after the first flight because my free flight was all screwed up. Even my starting procedures, I didn't know. I had to with a checklist. I had to look around and find all the circuit breakers and find all the different items that you got to go through on a checklist, which I didn't because I hadn't been in that cockpit for a long time. So it was getting reacquainted. And then we flew, and then so anyway, like I mentioned, that I was scheduled to fly with him the next day, same guy again. So I that night I got out there with a flashlight in the hangar and with a checklist and memorized it. Probably spent several hours out there, getting square away wherever all the circuit breakers and all the other things were that I needed to. And then the next day the flight went very well. It was a good flight.
Mm-hmm.
Like 100% improvement, and from there I never flew with him again. But it was, I think I related that story about the shutdown procedures that he.
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He says, that's the last time you'll ever sharpshoot me. And I'm thinking, well, geez, what does that mean? Is that, you know,
well,
it's,
yeah, what do you think he meant by that? Because
the guy was weird. I mean, I will say that. I mean, I got to be pretty friendly with Abbott in later years. But and, of course, he became vice president, one of vice presidents of Air America and a base commander there, a base manager. But but it turned out that we went R&R. See, one of the neat things, did I send you the Hong Kong story? Probably not.
Let me see. I've got Lofty Goals, Snake House, Upcountry Work Schedule, Detour to Burma. Let's see here.
Christmas
Eve, 1970.
Yeah.
And then I've got Rescue.
The Rescue, yeah.
And the Balaban's Plateau.
Yeah, which is the other half of the Rescue, same day. Okay.
Right.
Okay, well, I've written a lot of other stories, but one of them, you know, the work schedule at Air America was neat because you flew. When you were flying, of course, if you were upcountry and you flew hopefully 10 hours a day or more if you could, or you know, because that was the idea, is to get as much flight time as you could. You were paid for 70 hours a month. That's how your pay was based. And so as quick as you could get that 70 in, well, then anything you flew over 70 was with overtime. So you made more money that way. And the other thing is if you flew it fairly rapidly, well, then you wouldn't have to spend as much time away. You could, you know, you could be off.
Right.
Of course, when you weren't flying, you were off. I usually was home or played golf. There was a golf course there in New Dorn, that little nine-hole course that I played at. That's usually what I did. But every month, you had what you call STO, a scheduled time off, which was you had to be available for flight schedule 21 days a month.
Mm-hmm.
So the other, roughly the other week of the month, which was your time, scheduled time off. So you would normally time that or arrange that so that sometimes you had the last week of one month and the first week of the next month, so therefore you actually had 2 weeks off in a row. So, you know, that gave you a chance to travel if you want to go to the States or wherever.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, one of our favorite things was to go down to the Pattaya Beach or the Gulf of Siam, south of Bangkok, and just relax down there on the beach and eat seafood and play golf, and usually you'd plan that with other friends of yours and their families, and as I said, anyway, Ab and his family occasionally would be down at the same time we were, so we'd get together for dinner or whatever, so I got to know him that way a little better, and normally we had tried to keep the same group, we had the group of friends that we would try to do these R&Rs with. We must have made, probably during the time, we probably made 15 to 20 trips to Hong Kong. It would only cost, I believe it was something like $20 on Cathay Pacific to fly to Hong Kong, and for each of us, and we got a 50% discount at most of the hotels. So we always would usually stay at the Peninsula, which was at the time was the best hotel in Hong Kong.
Mm-hmm.
Pick you up with a Rolls Royce at the airport, and unpack your bags, and you know, all these niceties. It was a real classy place, and then normally it was full, but Air America had some office space in that building, and so there, whenever we'd call for a reservation, they'd always find room for us.
Wow.
And so there were some neat things, like, you know, and Hong Kong was a neat shopping area, of course. Everything was available. Of course, I, like everybody else, had a gold Rolex that I bought in Hong Kong, and the presidential Rolex. And back in those days, when the price of gold was $35 an ounce, it was, I think it cost about $700 for the one that's probably $9,000 or $10,000 now.
Mm-hmm.
And we had customized clothes made and shoes and, you know, all the different things, fun things you do in Hong Kong. Plus, we bought, during our time over there, we ordered a house full of, pretty much a house full of furniture to have made for us, to be made for us over there, Chinese, you know, rosewood and teak and all the good stuff. And so at the point of finally finished, after the probably 5 years we had it shipped home. So anyway, those were neat times, but you know, when you're off the work schedule,
you got to travel like that very inexpensively.
Yeah, we did, because the way that worked is that Air America was considered Air Asia or CAT was considered an airline, just like Pan Am or any of them. So we got the normal inter-airline discounts for number one, and the other thing was every year they would give you the equivalent money in airline or MCOs, they call them, change orders for travel, of what it costs for you and your family to go full fare to the States and back. Well, that was enough because I could actually go all the way around the world for $199 on TWA with as many stops as I wanted back then. And I had an 80% discount on Pan Am, at least a 75% discount on most every other carrier, and then within the continental U.S., at least a 50% discount. So I could take those MCOs and get tickets, discount tickets, and so that would allow us to travel to Hong Kong or to the States several times a year and still be working on what my allowance was for that annual trip or that annual entitlement. So that was a good deal. So therefore, we traveled quite a bit. We'd go to Amsterdam a lot. If we went the eastern route to the U.S., we would go through Amsterdam and then on into all the way into Houston on KLM through Toronto it was Canada and then on into Houston. Of course, we were living in Texas, so we just rent a car in Houston and going up to Mineral Wells. I mean, that's where our home record was at the time, where Linda's family lived, and we kept a house there too during those years, and then. Or we take the other route, which was on UCN Pan Am or TWA or one of the U.S. carriers, and that would go through Japan and then Hawaii or sometimes northwest into Seattle where my family was, where I was from. But anyway, we would or stop in Hawaii and then go on in through L.A. and then all the way into Dallas. So it gave us a neat break either way. You know, for a long trip. Of course, the kids traveled with us, and even when we were in Thailand, and they went with us to the beach, we'd take a house girl with us to you know babysit and mm-hmm. and help with that with the kids that way. So it was a neat life.
Sounds like it.
Yeah.
Well, when you got to
Udorn.
Udorn. Yeah. Well, actually, when you first got to Taiwan.
Yeah.
And you went through your initial training. What kind of briefing did you receive about Air America, the role that they were playing in Southeast Asia, mission,
nothing,
stuff like that?
Nothing really at Taipei. It was simply a lot of things were just kind of implied to be classified, and they didn't talk about it. All we talked about was aircraft, which could have been aircraft in Udorn. It could have been aircraft in Houston, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's an aircraft. Plane's a plane. Mm-hmm. So we talked, you know, that. Because we were there to get a license and a physical.
Right.
Same in Bangkok. We didn't get into either rumors about this and that, but we didn't get into that. I didn't start hearing about the missions up country until I actually got up to Udorn. Of course, a part of our in process, and of course, part of your daily procedures when you fly was an FIC brief they call it, which is your intelligence brief, and they had it together. Now I could tell right away once I got working up with Air America, the difference between their operation and the Army's operation in Vietnam was like night and day. Mm. It was, I mean, it's indescribable. First of all, the level that we were allowed to participate is just a pilot in command of an aircraft or a captain over there was at the highest level. And that we were in on the decision-making on how we're going to do the mission. It wasn't just throwing at you like, yeah, you will do this, and that's how it's going to go. You know, no discussion. Mm-hmm. There was always a room for discussion up there on those. And then the other thing, there's our intelligence briefs were very well updated and coordinated and pretty and very accurate. Any time an aircraft was fired at Laos, that information immediately was relayed back through the different systems and was noted on the briefing board in the FIC.
Mm-hmm.
That you know this at this date at 1400, 50 caliber rounds were fired in an aircraft right there, or a 37 millimeter was spotted right here, or a 23 millimeter in an aircraft, the different ones. So you had a good idea, where not to go. And on Laos, of course, the difference was we were unarmed. We were generally by ourselves flying there, so you didn't have a bunch of aircraft with you. So when we did a mission in infill exfil, we did have an SAR bird on those missions. We would have an empty bird if we're doing what they call a special mission, where you might get one of us may get shot down. So you got the empty bird to be able to get you out. And when I was the senior pilot, of course, when I was new, I wasn't, but after a few years, I was one of the senior H-34 pilots, and so I would be able to to plan how the mission was going to go as far as the flight portion of it. You know, who was going to lead, who was going to land, who was not going to land, who was doing, you know, where, what each crew was going to do. And of course, what I always did, I always led the mission because I wanted to be first in, first out, and I wanted to navigate too. Most of the guys are really good, but I trusted myself better to make sure we were at the right place at the right time. And then I would pick whoever I felt would be the bravest to be the SAR.
Mm-hmm.
Figured if I got first one in, got shot down, then he would come and get me.
Right.
And you know, Air America was like in Vizelles. They weren't all heroes. There were some guys that were timid. There were some guys that you couldn't trust if you're for sure if they'd come and get you or not.
Mm-hmm.
If you're, you know, if there was a lot of shooting going on, and other guys, you figured they would.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway.
Well, when you left Taipei and went to Udon.
Yeah, by way of Bangkok.
By way of Bangkok.
Yeah.
How long did you stay in Bangkok?
About another week or so.
What happened there?
We had H-34 ground school. Are you there?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Somebody's trying to call in on me here, but that's okay.
Okay. So a week of ground school.
Yeah.
And then from there on to Udon to actually start flying missions.
Yeah. Well, you were training. At first it was training. Yeah.
Initial training.
Initial training, flight training right there at the Udon base. But then that was only for a couple of days. And then I think I stayed there about 3 days of training. With 2 days with Abadi. I think I had one other flight with somebody. And then went up country with a captain and with a training captain and for a 5 day, 4 or 5 day mission.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Where were you actually licensed through? Was it you had a Chinese license?
Yeah, but I had
the
only requirement by the contract was an FAA commercial license.
I see.
And that's another funny thing. Some of the early pilots, of course, especially ones that just come right out of the military, didn't have a pilot's license.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they'd been flying there for a long time, and then suddenly it was realized that hey, so and so doesn't have a license. You know, when that block was not checked right, during your annual or whatever, and so they had to get these guys' licenses,
mm-hmm.
which is kind of funny. And because I mean, they were obviously very experienced pilots, but they just had always been military flying. So,
right.
But I had a pilot's license, so I am. And of course, the physical, which goes with that, is taken care of by the company over there. The ATP requires every 6 months. However, we didn't have to operate as an ATP pilot, only as a commercial pilot.
Okay.
So it was every year we had an annual physical.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Now, so the first 2 months that you spent there to Udon, you went through H-34, you continued H-34 really flight training.
Yeah.
Refamiliarization.
Yeah.
Did you ever fly over the border, or was it always in Thailand itself?
Well, we started out in Thailand, like I said, for the first few days in Udon,
mm-hmm.
and then from there we went on. We flew up into Laos and trained on the regular missions.
Yeah. Okay. So even though it was training, you were basically participating in regular Air America mission operations.
Affirmative. Yeah.
Okay.
It just, you know, the pilot in command, the captain was a you know, an experienced guy that he would. In fact, a lot of our Air America flights were solo in the helicopters, even up country.
So even before your 9-day probationary period was up?
No, yes. And before my I was upgraded to captain, because mm-hmm. you can't fly solo unless you're a captain.
Mm-hmm.
But I was upgraded to captain in about 60 days.
Okay.
After I got there, which was great.
Mm-hmm.
It was quicker than I would assume that I would probably be upgraded somewhere on the 90-day period, but
mm-hmm.
I made it in 60 days, which was good. You had to be recommended by the, every time you fly up there, you know, they write a report on you, you know, how you did and what you did. And then, and based on that, they'll give you a flight eval, their chief pilot will, to see if you're ready, and then he signs you off as the captain or pilot command.
Okay. Who was the chief pilot that signed you off?
Yeah, well, I think actually the guy that signed me off was the chief flight instructor was probably either Jerry McEntee or Wayne Webb. The chief pilot of helicopters was Wayne Knight,
mm-hmm.
who I see him at the reunions.
Mm-hmm.
He lives in Australia, really a super guy,
mm-hmm.
super guy.
Yes, sir.
And in fact, all of my, you know, I enjoyed the helicopter crews a lot over there. And never, ever will there be another group of that caliber of professional helicopter pilots in one unit.
Right.
Just, you know, because they all, most have already been to Vietnam and then before they even got there. And then and flying that terrain and that and those conditions year after year after year, you're real good or you're not going to make it.
Mm-hmm. Well, in those the first 60 days that you were flying, when you finally received your captain's rating,
yeah.
About how many hours do you think you flew?
I flew about probably about 160 hours there, probably about mm-hmm. 80 hours a month, 80 to 90 a month.
Mm-hmm. That's pretty good.
Yeah, it was enough to keep me real proficient.
Yes,
get me proficient. And that's what I flew throughout the tour. Like I said, you're paid for 70, so they want you to fly at least 70 a month.
Right.
And then sometimes we'd fly up to 100 a month. Normally you wouldn't get more than 100, but they tried to follow the FAA rules too. The Part 91 is not more than 100 hours in a 30-day period without so much rest and so on. If they could, they'd follow that.
Well, describe for me, if you would, the first mission you flew solo.
Okay, the first one up there solo was, in fact, that was kind of, I don't even remember what we did. We went up and we supported somebody, and I flew probably rice and people around from villages to villages and that kind of thing. But I remember I had a Filipino crew chief. A lot of the crew chiefs were Filipino, or flight mechanic, they call them, but crew chief. And good guys, and really, and those, the good thing about the Filipinos, they can adapt to any language. They not only spoke English real well, they spoke Thai, they spoke Lao, they spoke, of course, their own, Hispanic type Filipino language, and so they were handy too, especially at first because they could speak any language. But and of course, we had Thai crew chiefs, we had Thai co-pilots, we had of course, Americans too, obviously, and the crew chiefs. But anyway, that very first flight, I don't remember if it was the first night where we RON'd or what, but after a couple of days, I was told to fly back to an RON or remain overnight in Vientiane, which was a pretty good deal because there you'd stay in a hotel and it was kind of like, coming back to town. Up country, I'll get into the hostel business. We usually stayed in hostels up there. Now, see, I didn't send you the long story, did I?
No, sir.
Okay, well that explains how some of the hostels were. But anyway, you would generally fly to an area up there and work for a customer for up to 6 days. You'd just stay with him or live up there and either a hostel if Air America had one or in a local hotel up there And for the helicopter, for the H-34 pilots, we flew everywhere in Laos. Every major area in Laos we lived at,
mm-hmm.
all the way from the farthest north, which was Bon Uisai, all the way down through to the furthest one south, which is Pak Sae, down here on the Cambodian border, and about 15 bases in between we could RON at. So, and most of the larger ones had a hostel where there was a cook there. The food was actually pretty good, and then you would sleep and fly out of that part of that local airfield was with your customer, your air ops guy, his office is out there at the airfield, and he would give you your missions, your loads, where you're going, what you're going to do, and so on. And then each time you come back in, they would have another mission for you. And, usually what it was, he'd just hand you, you wouldn't get out of the aircraft, he'd hand you a piece of paper with some coordinates on it, and the signal for the day, that coordinates, you had to always flying high, look down for a signal. They put out with cloth, either an O, an I, a T, an X, or what, something. And as long as that was what it was supposed to be, then you would go ahead and that meant you were cleared to land.
Mm-hmm.
And anyway, my first trip with a solo or on my own, we were returning to Vientiane, and there's an area called Twin Peaks, which is and that's what it is, two little mountains kind of together. You know, Laos has a lot of mountains.
Mm-hmm.
And we're flying, but Vientiane's kind of it's down on the Mekong River, so it's fairly flat down there. So coming out of the mountains toward Vientiane, I had estimated that the flight time from Twin Peaks was about a half an hour to Vientiane. And I didn't have much more fuel than that on board. I had about 45 minutes of fuel. And I could have landed there at Twin Peaks because there was a refueling point. But see, we refueled by hand. You know, you'd land, you'd get a drum of a 55-gallon drum. You had a hand pump, and you'd just pump your 115, 145 ab gas into your helicopter. Your crew chief would, you could help him, and you'd filter it through a chamois, through a chamois into a funnel and into the aircraft. So that would take about, 10 minutes to do a 55-gallon tank. So, and of course, the aircraft would hold about 200 gallons, all told. So, you could be, and a lot of time you didn't want to waste as much time as you wanted refueling if you didn't need to. So I said, we can make it. So I started on back, and I'll be darned, as I was leaving Twin Peaks, the 30-minute low fuel light came on, which tells you got about 30 minutes left of fuel. And I didn't worry about it. I'm heading on down toward Vincennes. Come to find out, it's like a 50-minute flight. And so I was still about probably 10 miles, for 15 or 20 miles maybe, from the airport, and reading zero. And even the flight mechanic kind of looks up. Well, he's down below. An H-34, if you can picture, when the pilots sit up high, mm-hmm. up in the front, and then the passengers and the crew guy are down below. And, of course, he's looking up between my legs up toward the fuel gauge, and he says, "Hey, we're going to make it," And I said, "Yeah." I said, "No sweat, we'll make it." But I was worried about that, and we did make it okay. But when I finally got over the end of the runway, I figured, well, of course, now at least I'm going to land on the runway. And then taxied on into the parking area to refuel. There couldn't have been much. I didn't even ask how much fuel it took. I was afraid. I was thinking, my first flight alone, and here I'm going to run out of gas, get fired. Yeah, that's something that's been close to. But there was a lot of exciting times over mm-hmm. there flying.
Mm-hmm.
But that's, I don't remember a whole lot of specific. Well, I do remember, of course, the rescues I remember. And,
yes, sir.
And I remember certain missions that were scarier than other ones. And there's a lot of really interesting terrain and interesting local folks that the different tribal people that live in the different areas of Laos. Laos is it's like 10 different languages. They don't all speak the same language in Laos. So you've got these different males and the Hmongs and the different tribes that, of course, the ones we supported a lot. I mean, that were with us with Vang Pal, his people up in they were the hill people up in the high country.
Mm-hmm.
And we call them males, but they were Hmongs, with an age, Hmongs with an age, and good fighters, good soldiers. And of course, we worked a lot with them.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, the Laotian Army guys, they were, okay. We flew them somewhat, but depending on what the mission and what the customer was.
Mm-hmm.
There were three main customers, we call customers. There was a 713 customer, which was the CIA, and they were actually the case officers that had the various, a lot of them had battalion-level commands there, and they, and we would work, we had mercenaries, two from Thailand, and we would work with them. But that was mainly the Hueys out of what they call Site 20 Alder, which was Longchen. That was that secret base up there,
mm-hmm.
You probably heard about.
Yes, sir.
That's usually where they, and I didn't fly out. I flew out of there somewhat, but H-34s flew everywhere else, and the Hueys flew exclusively right for that particular job.
Was there a specific reason as far as aircraft capability or limitation for that?
Well, I don't know. Of course, the Huey was more pleasant to ride in for the customer because it didn't make as much noise as that H-34 with that big old 18-20 rotary, 9-cylinder rotary engine mm-hmm. on it with shot fire and smoke out the exhaust,
mm-hmm.
But for that reason, they probably would rather ride in a Huey because it was cool. And they were Hueys are better at higher elevation because they have a turbine engine.
Mm-hmm.
An H-34 at sea level and a Huey are equal in power, but as you get higher, the recip engine loses their power,
mm-hmm.
and you got to really rely on a good pilot technique to be able to land and take off that thing.
Mm-hmm.
With a load, but I would think also that probably different contracts aircraft were assigned the 713 contract or the CIA would probably paid for those Hueys, and they were probably felt they owned them, I guess. I'm not really sure how that worked accounting-wise, but that was what I figured. Whereas we worked USAID, USAID, which was always interesting work. It was usually hauling rice, but a lot of times it was hauling refugees and hauling and picking up sick people and taking bodies, soldiers back to their villages, usually they were just wrapped up in a poncho or something or a blanket, and they'd load them aboard your aircraft and give you a coordinate, and you take it to the village and unload it and go, or pick up people that they told you to pick up, type of thing.
When you transported soldiers' remains back to their villages, the dead bodies, would anybody accompany them back with them?
Sometimes yes, sometimes no. They would know we were coming,
right?
And so somebody would meet us. But in fact, I've got another funny story there. We were flying out of Site 20, which is a place called Samtong, which was near Long Chin, near Site 20, Alderman, but it was over the mountain from it.
Okay.
And that's where, have you ever heard of Pop Buell?
Yes, sir.
Okay, that's where he had his headquarters.
Okay.
And it was a USAID strip there. And also Father Bouchard, Luke Bouchard, the missionary, he was famous. I used to give him rides occasionally. But anyway, Pop Buell, that was his area. And I was working out of there, and it was raining real hard, and that runway was kind of a slant, so that it was like during the real hard rain, it was like a river, but you would taxi the aircraft on up to the loading area, which was kind of on the edge of the runway, and they came out with this body wrapped in a poncho, and it was getting later toward the evening. It was probably going to be my last flight of the night because it was raining too, so the visibility wasn't real good. You didn't fly after dark if you could help it, because of a lot of reasons it was. The mountains are dark up there, and it's pretty bad terrain. And
yes,
of course, you went down; nobody could find you. And probably, and the other thing was, it really wasn't that big of a reason to fly at night. So, he gave me the coordinates, and I took off and flew with just my flight mechanic and the body and the below. And we went over toward what I thought was the village and circled it, but nobody put out a signal.
Mm-hmm.
So I wasn't going to land without a signal. And to this day, I don't know whether I might have, hit the wrong village, but I never heard any difference. So I got back to with the body. I came back, it was dark. I taxied up to where we parked the aircraft for the night, or near there. First I taxied down to the load area, and where the guy met us, I said, "Hey, I still got the body." He says, "I'll just push it out of the aircraft and taxi up to, your parking area, and we'll resume in the morning." So we threw it out, but if you can imagine, it was still raining hard, and there was like a river. So the next morning we got down, and the body's still laying there, but now it's half covered with mud because the water had washed all this dirt on it, And I'm looking, I told the load guy, I said, "Hey, the Lao," but that spoke English, and I said, "What about the that guy? Should we go back?" And he said, "Nah, never mind." He said, "We'll take care of it later. He's dead. He doesn't care." So. Anyway, so I just did whatever I was doing with it for all morning, flew other, trips and everything, kept coming back, and that body's still laying there, still half buried, nobody's even touched it, and in the mud, and finally in the afternoon it was gone. I didn't take it, I don't know where who took it, but anyway, that was, I was just wondering if everybody ever was.
Mm-hmm. Well, when you got there, to Thailand, and then started flying your missions up country.
Yeah.
Were you surprised by the amount of activity, both American in support of Laotian and also enemy, that is Pathet Lao and North Vietnamese?
Well, no, I wasn't, because I knew the Ho Chi Minh Trail area was a major route for Vietnam, and I knew that was busy. Now, it didn't really happen right at first, but it was happening. The enemy, the North Vietnamese, were actually taking more and more Laotian territory, and starting out at the extreme northeast was Sam Nua Province, which juts up against North Vietnam. Actually, it's between North Vietnam and China. It's quite a bit north, but they would come in through there, and then head on down south through the different routes across with the Ho Chi Minh Trail, which was the eastern part of Laos, and then finally wander back into either Cambodia, continue on down to Cambodia, or do a turn east to Vietnam. And there was a lot of activity there, but the enemy would move in by the seasons, just like, for example, during the wet seasons, they would take ground because we didn't have a lot of Air Force support, or the Laos didn't, and we didn't have a lot of air support because the weather was bad. But during the dry season, when the weather was pretty good, well, then they would lose ground because we'd get in with the Air Force and be able to, you know, to bomb areas heavier, and that way we'd have our own offensive with the Laotian Army and the Bangkok's Army, and to drive them back out of those areas. So it was like a seesaw. Every year was the Plain of Jars. In fact, you've heard of the Plain of Jars, right?
Yes, sir.
PDJ, okay. Neat area. That's there are these large stone jars all over the, just sitting around this big, large plain that looks like a large golf course. It's about probably, 10 or 15 miles across in all directions. It's high elevation, too. It's like 3,000 feet or higher, and real pretty terrain. And it's good farming and good for raising cattle and stuff up in that area. But these burial jars are only in that area, and I mean, that's one of the mysteries of the world. According to legend, nobody really knows what they were there for. They figured, well, maybe they were burial jars or they cremated, but there really wasn't any proof of that. And how did they get there? Who knows? Supposedly, they were a different type of rock than was even found in that area. So, you know, how did they get there? They weighed tons, you know, each. Mm-hmm. And it was one of the interesting, you know, like these runways that are mystery runways that supposedly aliens built here. They weren't how those things got there. But anyway, that was a neat area to work. The plane of weather was a bad area. The PDJ was an area that, well, as I related in that one story, the Christmas Eve where I got shot up that time, I was supporting around the outpost around the edge of the PDJ, and got shot from the, you know, from there. Yeah. But
so when you say the, okay, in terms of the monsoon activity, what months were the best months for your activity in terms of controlling the PDJ?
March. And, I'm trying to remember how the seasons went. The driest seasons were like February, March, April, that in the spring, that mm-hmm. area. Mm-hmm. Of course, the only problem is when the weather was dry like that, then they would do the slashing and burning over there.
Right.
That's how they, you know, they cleared the
smoky season.
Yeah, and that was the smoky season. And they really got pretty smoky too in that part of the world. But that's just the way it, you know, you learn to fly in it. But
how long would that last?
Oh, about 4 or 5 months probably.
A smoky season would last that long.
Yeah, it lasts a long time. Wow. Several months at least, anyway.
Okay. But of course, that's less debilitating in terms of your operational capability than rain.
Yeah.
Than the monsoon.
Yeah, the monsoons were not only the rain, but of course the low visibility clouds. It would, you know, I'd gotten into situations over there where, you know, you really couldn't fly instruments because there weren't any nav aids. Mm-hmm. So you don't just go charging off into the clouds because there's 8,000 foot mountains up there. And 7,000 foot mountains, and so anyway, you got to know where you are, and so you don't go IMC on purpose, mm-hmm. and especially with an H-34, which doesn't really have the power to climb out very fast. You know, if you could climb right up through it, you had a lot of power. That's you could do that, but you just so you had to stay VFR, mm-hmm. and try to stay below the bad weather, above the small arms range, which was hard to do both. Sometimes, and then avoid the bad guys, which you generally knew where they were. So you just avoided those areas by experience.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, you picture you're flying an old aircraft, a heavy aircraft, underpowered aircraft, no nav aids, single engine, single pilot in many cases, trying to read a map and do all the things. It was it kept you busy.
Yes, sir. Now, how many hours could you stay aloft on without refueling?
About 2.5 to 3 hours at a time, I believe. And then a lot of times we would hot refuel. There were some areas where you didn't even have to shut down. You just refueled while you were running. So you never got out of the cockpit.
Okay.
You just kept sitting there.
Well, now, was that particularly dangerous?
No. Just... keep the money machine, keep that fan go above you turning.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. This will end the interview with Mr. Van Etten on the 15th of January.